Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Telltale Heart, a Cardiovascular Digest for Pharmacists. And as always, as we begin the new year, we're excited to jump into some great clinical topics. We have a great editorial calendar planned for the next year, including obviously all of our traditional meeting coverage and continuing to highlight specific areas and disease states that are hot and blooming in the cardiovascular space. And that's going to be one of the conversations today. I'm excited for my guest, but before we get in there, reminders, if you like our podcast, like and subscribe, follow, rate us. If you have comments or feedbacks or things you'd like to hear or questions, please let us know and send that however channels you want to send that, via my email or to Pharmacy Times, or you can put it in the comments or the chat. But please like, subscribe, rate, give us feedback, help us continue to make this better over the next year, or things that you would like to see. With that being said, I'm going to move into our conversation. And so I'm going to introduce our guest. And so first and foremost, I'm going to welcome Andrew Wilford to the podcast, and I'm going to let him tell you who he is and what his role is and what his practice is. And then we'll dive right into the topic of what we're going to cover today, which is actually something we've not covered yet. And I've been meaning to. There's been lots of trials that have come out in the last year in this domain, and I thought, you know, how am I going to start broaching this topic? Well, then I was at the Heart Failure Society of America meeting in September, and he and I were on a panel together, and he started, and I was like, oh, this is who I want to come talk about this. So I'm very excited to have that. So Andrew, tell him who you are, where you work, what you do, and we'll start from there. And then that may give the audience a clue to what we're going to talk about today. So,
yeah. Well, thank you very much for having me on the podcast. I really do appreciate it. I was super excited when I saw your email, and there was no way I was going to let this opportunity go. So I really thank you for having me on. But for everybody listening, my name is Andrew Williford. I am an assistant professor at the UC San Diego Skaggs School of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences. I trained as a PGY2 in cardiology back in 2021 over at University of Maryland School of Pharmacy. My resident program director was Stormy Gale, who I know probably quite a number of people know her. But I've been working as an assistant professor now at UCSD for about 3 years. I think my three-year anniversary is coming up this March. And I teach cardiology to our pharmacy students. And then my primary practice is at UC San Diego Health, where I run a telehealth GDMT titration clinic for heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, in addition to managing cardiac myosin inhibitors, particularly right now, mavacamten, for our patients with obstructive HCM who come to our center at UC San Diego Health.
Very good. And so if that didn't give anybody a clue, we are going to talk about hypertrophic cardiomyopathy today, which is a subset of a cardiomyopathy or in the heart failure domain. I think some people may or may not be familiar with this particular disease state, or will be learning. I think maybe there's more awareness now that there's other treatment options out there, because I think historically when we've had treatment, it's fallen into, and you'll probably talk about this, some of the classical domains of things we've used to manage a little bit differently. But like, you think about beta blockers, for example. So it wouldn't trigger someone to be like, oh, they have this disease state potentially if you're working in a community pharmacy or somewhere else. But I think it's good to have this type of conversation. And the neat thing, and I'm hoping to follow this up in the next episode, is I'm going to be bringing on, and I invited Andrew if he's interested in coming back. We're going to see. I have two family friends who have been recently in the last 3 months, 3 to 4 months, a daughter who got diagnosed with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And I'm hearing this story. My mom's telling me, I'm like, have they, like, I'm hearing the conversation about this. And I said, we need to get them to a place that looks or deals with this, because I'm concerned that there's, you know, and of course, turns out that's what the case is. And then, so they're telling me about the daughter. I'm like, and my mom's telling me about the mom. And so I'm like, oh, she needs to be tested too. And of course, you know, it turns out that they both, you know, had some so anyways, we're going to talk about their journey. But anyways, so Andrew, just can you give, since you work in this, and give in your words an overview of, you know, what hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is, and kind of explain the different types, because I think that helps us talk about how we're going to manage and treat and diagnose them But just kind of give the audience in your version or how you explain it or what this is in terms of what hypertrophic cardiomyopathy or HOCM means.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what you're saying too, I totally agree with in terms of HCM is a disease state that hasn't really been widely popularized, I guess, in the world of pharmacy, just purely because we didn't have a lot available to us. But you know, with newer therapies, we have a lot of opportunity for us pharmacists to be involved. And I think with more of us pharmacists involved, we'll be able to reach more patients, such as those individuals that you talked about. Just greater larger clinical workforce is just better in general for everybody or all around.
Right.
But you know, with HCM, it's a genetic cardiac disorder. It's characterized by cardiomyocyte hypertrophy or enlargement, and it affects the left interventricular septal wall, with that enlargement or hypertrophy having kind of basal, mid-septal, apical, or even more diffuse pattern throughout the left ventricle. It's With regards to kind of that genetic component, the most common genes implicated in HCM pathogenesis are in myosin heavy chain 7 and myosin binding protein C3. And it makes up about half of all familial cases of HCM. So kind of similar to what you're saying for the individuals earlier, is that it's a great idea, obviously, to get genetically tested and then have any first degree relatives and family members be tested as well, because it could be indicative of maybe a future case of I guess decompensation or just further symptoms in the future for patients with HCM. Now, depending on the morphology that I was talking about earlier, patients can also have a dynamic obstruction to forward blood flow out of that left ventricle, which is considered obstructive HCM, or OHCM is kind of the going term for it. Now, those without that obstruction to forward blood flow are considered non-obstructive HCM. So kind of generally, those are the categories of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. It kind of depends a little bit on the morphology. There's different genetic factors that or genes that are implicated in the pathogenesis of the disease state. But if we think about therapy-wise, the way that we have it split up currently is through obstructive versus non-obstructive HCM.
Yeah, and obviously, to your point, there's a lot of complexity around the diagnosis. There's of course echo criteria. There is a process. There's all processes, and we're not undermining this. And obviously, the pharmacist is aware of this, not necessarily performing all this work from this standpoint. But I think just for people to appreciate. Here's what the disease state looks like from a morphological perspective. You did a great job outlining this, and kind of it helps direct how your treatment strategy, and you'll talk about that in a minute. A little bit, the context tells you you're going to potentially manage these patients and what we have options for and what we don't have options for from that standpoint. So I think it's important to put it in there and to think through that. But obviously, we're clearly abbreviating and not undermining, but just providing a high level related to the diagnosis process from the standpoint. So just relatedly for people that don't know, what is the kind of outcomes or things for untreated patients with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy? What are the things, why do people need to be aware or care, or what does this look like? And given the two different types of cardiomyopathy that you just referred to.
Yeah, so I mean, if we think about just the pathophysiology of the disease state, patients with HCM at baseline have hypercontractility, some diastolic dysfunction, and really impaired cardiac energetics. And those pathophysiological changes are what translate into really a high symptom burden for individuals. And those symptoms kind of typically reflect those of individuals with heart failure. It's shortness of breath, exercise intolerance, lightheadedness and dizziness, syncope, palpitations, chest pain, very kind of cardiac sounding symptoms. And so it's hypothesized, at least in obstructive HCM, that those symptoms are in part secondary to the obstruction to forward blood flow. It's hypothesized that way because there are some kind of contradictory studies out there that say it could be something else, or it's a culmination of multiple factors. But kind of one of the going hypotheses is that the obstruction is in obstructive HCM is what is causing a lot of those symptoms. Now, in non-obstructive HCM, however, the cause of the symptoms is a little bit less clear, but it's thought to be still secondary to a lot of those pathophysiological changes that I mentioned
Right.
earlier, like diastolic dysfunction, et cetera. But you know, the beyond the symptom burden, which is large for patients, the kind of fortunate thing we have for patients with HCM is that the yearly mortality rate has actually decreased to less than 1%, which is really not secondary to just kind of improvement in interventions, not necessarily medicines, but more of interventions including like septal myectomy, ICD placement to help with sudden cardiac death, and even just transplantation. So the mortality rate is very low, which is good, but patients with HCM still have that high symptom burden and other complications, including arrhythmias. Kind of one of the estimates are about maybe 20% of individuals, if not more, with HCM have atrial fibrillation. You can still develop heart failure, and of course, there's a risk for sudden cardiac death. So all of that together with the symptom burden, patients with HCM just have very significant impact to their quality of life, which is why we have our therapies that we have now to help with.
Sure. And that's a great overview, and we'll get into that. So, I think that's an important message. And kind of what we were alluding to earlier, it's like, oh, not that hokum has not been around forever, and it's not that people haven't been aware of it. And of course, if you like have had experience in either academic medical centers or other areas, you see it pretty regularly, more regularly than you'd think. And kind of get used to accustomed to seeing them patient the patients. But of course, to your point, historically we've not had a lot of great options for some of the symptoms, especially the AFib, because it can be pretty persistent from that standpoint. Of course, there's been lots of changes in cardiology overall in terms of the management of various different disease states, hokum, AFib, all the things that are in there from that standpoint. But I think the true thing, there is risk, right? Because there is risk of sudden cardiac death that could occur. But of course, doing the things that you're alluding to and working through the process is always critical and important. And of course, when people have these symptoms or things and you're working through it and you see that change on an echo and you're like, oh, there's opportunity here, that's where you're going to kind of move forward. So how common is this, just to give people a perspective? So what are we looking at in terms of an epidemiologic rate of hokum?
So HCM, it's kind of funny. I mean, I guess it depends on how you look at it, but it's one of the most common genetic cardiac disorders, and it has a prevalence of 1 in 200 to 1 in 500. So you could say it's not that common, or it is common, but I would say every 1 in 200 individuals seems pretty common to me if you think about the grand scheme of things. So,
Right.
you know, in the United States, with that number in mind, it's thought there's maybe about 750,000 individuals with HCM currently living. And what's interesting too is, and it's good to know, is that the mean age for HCM is about 45. So patients with HCM, it's all up and down the board in terms of age. It's not a condition that affects just elderly or young. It is everywhere, which kind of goes hand in hand with the fact that it's genetic in nature.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so the thing is the as you're alluding to, is depending on the I guess what I'm trying to say, there's always could be a cycle of patients that are coming out depending on the genetic nature of the process and understanding the disease state and the risk that could be tied to this process. But I would argue with you, not argue with you, it's not an argument. You and I agree, like the numbers could not, based on what you're saying, it sounds insignificant, but just giving the rate and where that is, that's a decent number of patients and that you could
Totally
still be
agree.
encountering. And I think, and not to jump to your clinic, like what is your current panel of hokum patients that you're working with, just for example?
So I work mostly with individuals on cardiac myosin inhibitors, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But we have a panel of about, I think, 90 to 100 individuals that just the pharmacists work with
Sure.
individually. Total numbers for HCM, both non-obstructive and obstructive, is probably multiples of hundreds that come to UC San Diego Health for care. So it's a good number. We are tertiary center, so we get a lot of referrals outside too.
Yeah, I mean that's and with the type of need and follow-up, that's not a it's a decent amount of patients. It's not insignificant in that means and process. So very good. So just briefly, and I know you kind of alluded to this at the beginning, but just walk people through a little bit of a little more detail. I know pharmacists aren't doing the whole diagnosis or workup, but just what are some of the things we kind of alluded to at Echo? What are some of the things you do when you suspect someone having hokum that you're going to work them up through?
Yeah. So in terms of kind of, I guess you can think of a timeline for HCM workup. I mean, it usually starts with suspicion just from the symptoms that we talked about. So they come in, maybe see their PCP, and then they get referred to a cardiologist. Maybe there's an abnormal ECG that's gained or gathered, and you could see some left ventricular hypertrophy on the ECG. Or maybe if they even have family history of HCM or sudden cardiac death, those are other kind of objective pieces of data that would suggest maybe we need to go down this route. So as you kind of talked about, echo is the kind of the cornerstone of how we first start this workup. It's extremely important as it can easily be used to show us the first diagnostic criteria for HCM, which is really unexplained LV wall thickness of at least 15 millimeters or more, or if you have a family history, at least 13 millimeters. And this is in the absence of other causes that could potentially cause LVH, so like hypertension, et cetera. Or you can have a pathological variant from genotyping as well that would also be significant or objective for saying you have HCM. Now, the echo also can be used to evaluate whether or not you have that dynamic outflow tract obstruction in the left ventricular outflow tract. And the criteria is you just need a gradient of at least 30 millimeters of mercury across that left ventricular outflow tract to be considered obstructive. In individuals without HCM or obstructive HCM, you really have no gradient. There's maybe a little small one, but it's insignificant. You can also have, and it's very commonplace to get a cardiac MRI to further work up your HCM. It's often added on to get a better idea of what does the morphology truly look like and to actually detect any kind of fibrosis that's taking place in the heart. So data from everything I've already talked about, in addition to those gathered from rhythm monitoring, exercise testing that can be done, are used to kind of do risk stratification for sudden cardiac death, maybe give some consideration for ICD placement. And as I kind of mentioned earlier, again, very important to do genetic testing and family screening to try to ensure that we can follow up with other individuals who might be affected by this in the future.
Sure. And some of that also helps with staging for management, which we'll talk about here in a minute. But I think you nailed that beautifully in terms of how this process works and what it looks like, and understanding this. If you think about any cardiomyopathy that you're managing, a lot of the tools are very similar, right? Whether in terms of either diagnosing or understanding the degree of severity, we echo is a good tool. Cardiac MRI for people that aren't aware is very very good at providing details about structure and function and tissue. And then, of course, you do other types of testing around activity and that type of piece. So that's a whole fun component of that. And of course, as you alluded to, genetic testing, which people maybe in the oncology domain are very familiar with doing genetic testing in that process. But then you think about what does that look like in the cardiology domain. And here's a disease state that we kind of look at that same point, amyloid, another disease state where we do some genetic testing in that process to kind of work through those things. So very good. So now we get to turn to the part maybe the pharmacists are interested in. And so once you establish someone has this, and I would refer people, in my opinion, granted, maybe one of the newer agents that just got approved at the end of the year isn't in there yet. But and Andrew will probably talk about that agent in the trial with it. But the ACC has a very nice set of guidelines. The ACC/AHA has a very nice set of guidelines around hypertrophic cardiac that were published in 2024, I think, where it was the year that it was published. And they do a great job of outlining a lot of the stuff you talked about, but even the flow and the algorithm and what this looks like from a disease state treatment. So we'll put those in the show notes and reference people to those to talk through this for some of that standpoint. But it's a nice overview if you're interested. So, but anyways, Andrew, so what are some of the general management strategies? And I think you alluded to something that I'll go ahead and speak to that are not pharmacotherapy debated related is, device management. Who needs devices to prevent sudden cardiac death? What does that look like from that standpoint? So I think any form of study of cardiac death prevention is key. But when you talk about pharmacotherapy, What has historically been the management strategy, and then where are we kind of moving to and evolving from that standpoint? I guess if you want to start in one domain and then talk about obstructive and then non-obstructive, and however you want to do that, I'll leave that to you. So.
Yeah, it's a very fun, I guess, timeline of therapies for HCM because it's been very, very slow for decades and decades in terms of development and
Yeah.
understanding of how we can treat the disease state to all of a sudden we just have this new boom, which is the world of cardiac myosin inhibitors. But the general management for HCM really just includes utilization of therapies that decrease contractility. Because we know from the pathophysiology of HCM, it's a hypercontractile condition. So, based off of that understanding, we utilize medications that, like I said, decrease contractility. And which ones we use kind of depends on the category of HCM, so obstructive versus non-obstructive. Both types of HCM have hypercontractility, but in terms of what we have available for clinical evidence, most of it is in the world of obstructive HCM. So for obstructive HCM, we utilize therapies like beta blockers, which are considered first-line agents in the current 2024 guidelines, and also non-DHP calcium channel blockers, so verapamil, diltiazem, and then after our calcium channel blockers, we can utilize disopyramide, which is a class 1A antiarrhythmic that has pretty dang potent negative inotropic effects. Now, what's newer to that guideline is the cardiac myosin inhibitor. So that classification, first publication came out, I think, back in 2020 for mavacamten, the Explorer-HCM. And these medications really just work by essentially decreasing contractility directly at the cardiac myosin level. So beyond even all these medications in the world of obstructive HCM, if none of that works, or if maybe the patient elects to go off for it, patients can still get septal reduction therapies. So we haven't really mentioned it yet, but let's say patient, if we start from the top, they can't tolerate any of the medications, beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, cardiac myosin inhibitors, or disopyramide, they could go off for a septal reduction therapy, including a septal myectomy or even alcohol septal ablation. And that's all in the world of obstructive HCM. In the world of non-obstructive HCM, we don't really have many good options. The pathophysiology in terms of hypercontractility, like I said, remains the same, but the study data that we have available for us is pretty poor, especially in the world of beta blockers and non-DHPs. They are recommended in the guidelines for exertional angina and dyspnea, but again, the data for their use is actually extremely lacking. What's ongoing right now is utilization of cardiac myosin inhibitors in clinical trials for non-obstructive HCM. Unfortunately, mavacamten failed its phase 3 Odyssey HCM non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy clinical trial. What's ongoing is the competitor cardiac myosin inhibitor aficamten in Acacia. That one's still ongoing, so we'll see what comes out of that clinical trial. But I'm hoping something positive comes out of it, just purely because we don't have many options for individuals with non-obstructive HCM.
And so you did a nice overview. Let's go back before we get back into all the agents that we're using for management. Let's stop for a second and say, what are the things you don't want to give patients with HOCM that, are the no-nos or the things you have to be more cognizant of or closer to monitor with? I think that's a good conversation too.
Yeah, so it's a very good conversation to have because if we think about what's extremely common in terms of just across the board in just adults in general is hypertension treatment. A lot of people have hypertension, and we have a lot of drugs we can utilize to treat hypertension. Our go-to agent for many individuals in the treatment of hypertension would be thiazide diuretics. Work very well. We have great data for their use. But in the world of obstructive HCM in particular, we actually want to avoid thiazide diuretics. And the reason why is because in obstructive HCM, those individuals are what's kind of considered preload sensitive. They have hypertrophy of the left ventricle, so they already have a smaller cavity size to fill with blood. And then if they're obstructive as well, they also have that obstruction to forward blood flow. So these individuals, we need to make sure that their tank is filled up. I like to explain to my students and ask the question after I kind of show them and diagram out what the pathophysiology and what the chamber size looks like. And we talk about preload sensitivity. always at, like to ask them, like, I like to go to hot yoga. Do you think a patient with obstructive HCM should go to hot yoga? The answer is always no, because they get super dehydrated. They'll drop their preload, and then there'll be a huge risk for passing out, getting dizzy, lightheaded throughout that class. So thiazide diuretics for treatment of hypertension, big time no-no in terms of individuals with obstructive HCM as well.
So I like your example there because volume status is very important, right? And to your point, you don't want to over diurese patients with not just with thiazide, even if they're using loops for something, their volume status is very, very important. And so, if they're doing activities like being out in the sun or hot yoga or whatever that may be, or
Yeah.
they drink alcohol and get dehydrated or whatever they may be doing, that all can contribute to, if you empty that tank, they're going to fill that need to pass out from that standpoint. And there's
Definitely.
other things that can contribute to that. What other things do we avoid or try to limit?
Yeah, and so I think from a critical care perspective, or you could just, yeah, I could say just in the hospital, inpatient acute care side, what's really recommended to avoid are the agents. Let's say if the patient comes in with obstructive HCM and they are septic for whatever reason, they've gotten infected, their blood pressure's dropping, we need to give, and we've given them fluids, et cetera, and now we have to go into the whole pharmacotherapy vasopressor realm. And so our automatic first line agent that we can always consider for most cases is norepinephrine. But in a patient with HCM, it's actually recommended we avoid agents with any kind of beta 1 agonism. So, norepinephrine, while it is considered more highly potent for alpha 1, which is why it's a great vasopressor, it still has a little bit of that beta 1 effect. And so, we need to utilize agents that do not have any kind of positive inotropic effectiveness. So, that would be agents such as like phenylephrine. Theoretically, you could use vasopressin, but the go-to agent would be phenylephrine, which is actually recommended in the guideline for individuals needing vasoactive agents for whatever reason in the hospital.
Very good. A nice review, a little touch base for our hospital pharmacist there, from that standpoint. So let's go back down just to provide further clarity. When you talk about beta blockers, do you have a preference or do you care or does it matter or it's just beta blockers in general?
So great question. Good clarification too, because it's best to avoid the vasodilating ones. So ones like carvedilol. We want to go for the more beta selective ones. Metoprolol is fine. Perfect one to utilize. Bisoprolol would be fine. Just agents that don't have that alpha blockade effect. So the other kind of based off of the hemodynamic consequences of obstructive HCM, the idea is that if you drop afterload a lot for patients, you actually make their obstruction a little bit worse too. So things that can drop your afterload would be agents that directly vasodilate your arteries. So based off of the pharmacology, we would end up avoiding agents that have any kind of alpha 1 blockade.
And so I think that's important for people to recognize. And I'm probed you for this question because I think it, when you think about, this being a cardiomyopathy, you manage it a little bit differently than other cardiomyopathies, right? Or if you think about something like that, because you are worried about that kind of the tank being full and the afterload effect related to that. And they're very sensitive to these changes. Even like using nitrate sometimes can be a problem from that standpoint. But I think, it's important to be aware when someone says they have a cardiomyopathy, what cardiomyopathy you're dealing with and how to manage that. I think that's the general message is to your point. And it's like, we're going to use beta blockers, but we're not going to use these beta blockers, right? Because of this particular reason to help manage the patient and kind of be part of that. And then, so just in case people, and I like that you brought up, I know what we talked about the calcium channel blockers like verapamil and diltiazem, and those are really second line if they don't tolerate beta blockers, right? Because we know calcium channel blockers have other things that are problematic, whether it be drug interactions or tolerability pieces for some patients from that standpoint. But then you talked about disopyramid, and I think I feel like that's a agent for some people that they'll be like, I remember seeing this when I studied pharmacy school, but I've never actually seen, more often than not, when I see that agent listed on someone's med profile, it triggers me in to be like, oh, do they have hokum? Versus we're using that for an arrhythmia, right? And so, To your point, it's a very we're not using it for antiarrhythmics here. We're using it from a contractility perspective, and just understanding that people can have some tolerability issues with that standpoint. But anything you want to say about disopyramid or what?
Yeah. So, I mean, the medication, it works. It's just from a very practical perspective for the patient, it's a pretty obnoxious medication, I guess, is a way to pose it. I mean, it's multiple daily dosing, depending on the formulation. It still is really either BID or TID medication dosing. And it has anticholinergic side effects that take place at the entire range of dosing that you can take. Obviously, there's the QTc prolongation consideration to keep in mind. There's a little bit of maybe contention on whether or not you need to start the therapy in the hospital or you can start it in the clinic. I think you could start in the clinic, and we have data to demonstrate that because the actual prolongation is not as maybe as much as we think it is in terms of comparing it, I guess, apples to oranges to like sotalol, dofetilide, just when we talk about QTc prolongation among antiarrhythmics. But the medication class, it works based off of some data that we have from the mid 2010s. It's mostly all registry retrospective data. The typical dosing that you have to get patients to on average is about 450, somewhere around there, 500 milligrams daily. I've seen patients for ours before cardiac myosin inhibitors who were titrated all the way up to a total daily dose of 1,200 milligrams. That was wild. We actually ended up having to use extra medication to combat the anticholinergic side effects that the patient had. And so, not a great medication, but it does help to reduce the contractility and ultimately symptoms from obstructive HCM, anyways, in our patients.
And I want to remind, and you mentioned this earlier, but I want to remind folks that what we are trying to manage a lot is people's symptoms with this disease state, right? And that's because the mortality is lower. But to your point, you're adding something that helps with symptoms, but also has
Yeah,
other
side
challenges
effects.
to it, right? And that's always, but it's at the time for the longest time, that's the only thing we've had, right? And it's like,
Yeah.
here's what we have. And then obviously, before we get back into the newer agents, and I know we've talked a little bit about the myosin inhibitors. To your point, there's other things you can do like alcohol septal ablation or surgical myectomy and those types of things. And we're not going to spend an exorbitant amount of time talking about those because they are more surgically related, and not that they're not important, not that they're not an important tool in the management of the disease state, but just to keep with the theme of pharmacotherapy from that standpoint. So I know you kind of started talking about the myosin inhibitors and you talked a little bit about the studies, but would you further elucidate on, what the studies kind of were aimed to do and show, and how, how we apply them, or what is the aim of what we apply to them? And then, not to go over just the evidence. So think about the evidence and what we're using them for and what the outcomes are. But then for you, like, and you can talk about your clinic even, what are the things that we have to think about as a pharmacist? Because there are some unique things about that with using these agents and the management.
Yeah, so our newer agent class, cardiac myosin inhibitors, the ones that we have available are mavacamten. That's been around for about 4 years now. And then aficamten, which you highlighted a little bit earlier, just gained FDA approval at the end of December, like mid-December, so I think the 19th of 2025. They work by selectively and reversibly binding to cardiac myosin to inhibit cardiomyocyte contractility. And so for we think kind of chronologically, at least with regards to mavacamten, it was studied in the phase 3 placebo-controlled randomized controlled trial EXPLORE-HCM as in addition to VALOR-HCM. They both showed improvements in exercise tolerance through a cardiopulmonary exercise test, symptoms classified through NYHA, and the quality of life is measured by the Kansas City Cardiomyopathy Questionnaire. And again, this was in patients with obstructive HCM. So, not to be confused with non-obstructive HCM, this was obstructive HCM. So, Explore and Valor were the first ones that demonstrated that, hey, patients feel a lot better and they can exercise, have better quality of life, and do all these things that they want to have that has been limiting them for most of their life. Aficamten was put onto into popularity not long after. It was studied in the placebo-controlled phase 3 trial SEQUOIA-HCM that was published in, I think, May 2024. And very similar to Explore and Valor, It showed improvements in exercise tolerance, symptoms, and quality of life as measured by KCCQ. So when we look at the two or the three trials amongst each other, or if we just compare aficamten to mavacamten and we look at the actual clinical data comparing apples to oranges, they have very similar outcomes from an effectiveness or efficacy standpoint. Patients feel better, they can exercise better, they report better quality of life. And even when we assess them from that perspective of NYHA class assessment, they look better as well.
Very good. So definitely see improvement in symptoms, just to summarize, improvement in symptoms. And we do see, because we're changing those symptoms, they're able to be more active and engaged or ha see those improvements that we see in NYHA Heart Association. And so just to make sure we're really clear, there's no mortality gains with these,
Right.
correct?
And a lot of that, I always like to contextualize it for students and residents that come into my clinic, is that HCM has that going rate of mortality of less than 1% per year, which is hardly anything, which means if we were ever to find a medication that truly would help with mortality, statistically, I think it would be impossible for us to actually detect that. The
It
event
would be
rate
a,
just.
such a large amount of patients. I don't think you
Yeah.
would enroll them, right? So,
Exactly.
yeah.
And the number of patients who have HCM in the United States, that's estimated is 750,000. I don't know. I guess we could do a power calculation, but
Yeah.
I just don't know if even that's enough to actually
Right.
determine. So
Sure.
yeah, this was
So, yeah.
completely symptom.
Yeah. It's very good. So, tell us a little bit about the nuances of. Well, actually, let's actually, it'll be important if we ask the nuances of starting someone on this agents, titrating someone on these agents. What are you doing with these patients? How are you educating them? Tell us a little bit about that, because there is some things to be aware of depending on the agent that you're using, correct?
So I guess it's easiest if we just kind of put them in their buckets first.
Sure.
So we start with, mavacamten. Every time we get a new patient in my clinic, the pharmacist takes care of pretty much everything after the referral, including education. And so we always educate the individual about what are the expectations of what this drug is supposed to do, which is just like what we alluded to and talked about, is it's supposed to help with your symptoms. So we talk about like what are your limiting things that you have. And then we reflect back on saying this medication is here to hopefully help make it so that you can go on your run for longer. Or I had a patient who said, I actually really want to go skiing. I used to ski all the time. Now I can't. I just get too winded. I can't do any of it. And just kind of like cut to the chase. He actually went skiing after he started one of these therapies. He feels awesome.
Right.
But we educate what's the purpose. It's about helping with symptoms, improving quality of life. For mavacamten as well, we always tell them, hey, there are restrictions to the therapy. It's under a risk evaluation mitigation strategies program. This is born out of the safety side of the medication that we saw in those same trials that we talked about. So with mavacamten in Explore and Valor HCM, we did see some reduction in the left ventricular ejection fraction to less than 50%. So getting into the LV systolic dysfunction realm. The range of patients who actually had this happen to them was on the range of about 3.5 to I think 5% of individuals out of these clinical trials. Long-term open label extension studies of those same patients, the number of individuals throughout up to I think 180 weeks has been published for Explorer. It's about I think 8% of the patient population has had a reduction in their EF while on mavacamten. So that effect is reversible. So we tell them, there is a risk for something called systolic dysfunction, which can lead to heart failure. So systolic dysfunction, we always like to try to characterize and define what that means is your heart pumps out blood, and we measure how much blood pumps out of it as something called your ejection fraction. And what's normal is greater than 50%. And this medication inherently works to decrease how hard your heart is pumping, but which is what we want, but we don't want it to do too much. So if you get too much in your system, it can go down into the realm of less than 50%, which is at risk for heart failure symptoms. Not everybody has the symptoms of heart failure, but that's because we catch it throughout all of these REMS echocardiograms that are required for us. So we tell patients you have to follow up with your echocardiograms. We will schedule everything. We'll work with you throughout every single echo. We will call you at every single echo and talk about your results with regards to your ejection fraction. We'll also talk about How you're doing with regards to your left ventricular outflow tract gradient. So we always try to define exactly what that is for individuals. I always like to tell individuals with obstructive HCM is the LVOT gradient is just a number that tells us and correlates with your potential amount of symptoms that you have. It's not perfect, but our goal is to try to reduce that number down to pretty much close to zero or at least less than 20. So we're looking at your echoes, getting all that information. You have to show up to get to them, to get your echo done. Otherwise, we can't send the medication to you. And every time we have a conversation, we're going to ask you if you have new medications because there are drug interactions, which is important from us as a pharmacist side.
Pharmacy standpoint, yeah.
Yeah. So there's a good handful of drug interactions with mavacamten. It's a 3A4 substrate, 2C19 substrate. I always like to tell people, other clinicians that we train into our clinic is don't rely on one list that's provided to you for drug interactions. Always look it up, especially with new medications that you're not familiar with. You never know. And the other issue with mavacamten is it is also not only a substrate of those enzymes, it's also an inducer. So there's the potential for mavacamten to induce and therefore decrease the effectiveness of other medications that are 3A4 and 2C19.
There
So
you
those are all the things that we have to keep in mind for MAVA at least.
go. Or what about
And
our newer agent just approved?
yeah, so
Yeah.
the newer agent, aficamten, that's just approved for, in terms of its REMS program, which is supposed to go live at the end of this month, January. And its REMS program is maybe a little bit more forgiving than the mavacamten REMS program, just from the standpoint of it allows for a wider range of echocardiograms, the range at which you get them. So mavacamten, when you first start therapy, you have to get echoes every 3 to 4 weeks, 3 months in a row, and then you can make a dose increase after pretty much 3 months of therapy. For aficamten, you start therapy and then you can get your echo as early as 2 weeks or even as late as 8 weeks. So there's a lot more buffer room to really work with the patient's schedule. That I think is probably the most practical barrier of just actually the class in general is if patients have to show up to get their echocardiogram to get their medication, that means they can't go anywhere else. We've had patients that need to kind of change vacation plans in order to actually get their echo and get their medication. But with aficamten, like I said, that window is much larger, the 2 to 8 week window, which allows for a lot more flexibility with regards to scheduling. So, kind of a nice practical side of things. But again, still, it's going to be required. You have to get that echo in order to get the medication. From a drug interaction standpoint, aficamten still has drug interactions. I had a feeling it would when we looked at the initial PK data that was presented at ACC this last year, that it would have some labeled drug interactions. So aficamten is a 2C9 and 3A4 substrate, not to be confused with 2C19, which is MAVA. Afi is 2C9 and 3A4. So there are specific labeled drug interactions that you have to look out for that are actually listed in the package insert. The nice thing about aficamten, though, is that it doesn't induce any enzymes, so you don't have to worry about the flip side where afi will potentially decrease the effectiveness of some other drug. So that's kind of the nice thing that we get out of the PK side of things with afi.
Very nice. Anything else you would say about the MyCite inhibitors?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the risk for systolic dysfunction, while anywhere from 3.5%, which again was actually in Sequoia, for reduction in EF to less than 50%. While that amount of individuals who had a reduction in EF seems low, it's still a very important side effect, which I think is why that REMS program for both of these agents is extremely important because it ensures that clinicians, ourselves, et cetera, are monitoring appropriately for these therapies. The nice thing with afi too is that you actually make dose adjustments based off of a reduced EF. So if your EF is between 40 to 50% with aficamten, you just make a dose reduction. If it goes to less than 40%, you have to hold therapy. For mavacamten, if it goes below 50% on an echo, you hold therapy and then you have to let the drug wash out and then restart it.
Very
So
nice.
with all of that in mind, the REMS program very important in my opinion. Even though it might seem cumbersome, it's a very necessary thing to have.
But I like what you presented, A, about the titration, so people may be aware of that. But also, it's a good awareness. So if you're like in community pharmacy, being aware of the drug interaction piece and what that looks like from that standpoint. So it's definitely stuff that can be applicable to whatever your pharmacy practice may be, whether you're in cardiology or not, or whatever that piece.
Definitely.
So tell me just briefly, you kind of alluded to it, and you've actually explained a lot what you already do. But just is there anything else you would add about the clinic you are a part of and how you're managing these patients?
Yeah, so it's awesome too because I love the fact that I get to integrate well with our specialty pharmacy at UC San Diego Health, where I get to understand a little bit more on the specialty side of how they manage the medication and then how I help with the management from the clinic perspective. I think about our profession in general. Our pharmacists can be directly involved just from the specialty side, where they are involved intimately with the REMS program to make sure the status forms are complete and that the patient is being screened properly for drug interactions, in particular with mavacamten, and ensuring that the status forms are indicating in a very straightforward fashion that, hey, this patient has this LVOT gradient, has this ejection fraction, they are okay to continue therapy. So, from the clinic side, which is what I'm involved with, what I do is we have a pretty heavy pharmacist-driven CMI protocol. So, we adopted mavacamten very quickly, and we will be taking on aficamten once it becomes commercially available at the end of this month. But the way it works in our clinic at UC San Diego Health is our patients see our cardiologist, and our cardiologists do the whole workup, everything, all the echoes, cardiac MRIs, all the risk stratification for HCM. And then for individuals who qualify for a cardiac myosin inhibitor, they refer the individual over to us, and then we take care of everything. So we do all the education, we do the drug interaction screening, we do all of the patient assistance program enrollment, help and process. And then we also order all the echocardiograms, send out the prescription, make dose adjustments on the follow-up echocardiograms. And we keep track of everything all in the background, doing everything over telehealth to get the patient to their optimal dose. So all the while we're doing this, the patient just follows up with the cardiologist at kind of the mercy of the cardiologist's schedule, which at UCSD, they're so busy, they only have about a opening every 3 to 6 months.
Right.
So our objective, we
You
do
provide
everything
access.
exactly. Yeah, we are access. I like to describe to the patients, we are bridges in terms of your contact with your health. And so we get to help and guide you through this whole process in between when you see the cardiologist in person.
Very awesome. And so if people are more interested in Andrew, we'll talk about how you can reach out to what he's doing soon. Thank you for your time today. This has been a great overview, and we've covered a lot and gotten to dive down in there. And we'll put some of the studies in there, and like I said, the guidelines for people if they're interested in reading more. So, Andrew, we always ask people some non-clinical questions because people have lives outside of this. Just so if you guys weren't aware, before we start recording, Andrew's 10-month-old daughter, you said, right? The daughter.
Yep, 10-month-old
Yeah, was
daughter.
trying to come into the podcast, crawling in here. But so what are you reading or listening to or watching? What is something that you've been kind of engaged in beyond the pharmacy world recently?
Yeah, I will tell you the truth. The number one thing, and this is every year, it's an annual event for myself, and it lasts multiple weeks. I get really into football. So, a
Okay, you've been watching a lot of football
lot of
or
NFL football.
NFL.
Yep.
Okay, very good.
Yep.
Very
I'm a
good.
huge Seahawks fan. I'm originally
So
from
that's
Oregon. So,
okay. So that's what you've been in when you're not doing pharmacy or doing your 10-month daughter, your work 10-month-old daughter, you're doing football right now. So very good.
yeah.
All right. And then kind of an odd, even odder specifically question we're asking people, like if you had a TV show theme song or opening credit scene that is memorable to you, what is that
Oh
show?
man. I mean, to tell you the truth, I can't think of a really memorable TV show
Yeah,
with an
okay.
opening entry anyways. But I mean, one of my favorite shows that I've watched recently was actually The Penguin. I know it's been around for
Oh
a while now, but man, that show is so good. It's just so enthralling, very dark, but it is an excellent TV show. One of my
Very
favorites
good.
by
I'll
far.
have to check that one out. So,
Oh,
Andrew,
it
if people
is.
wanted to find you, how could they find you? Are you on social, or do you just have a faculty page? What is the way that if people wanted to learn more about your clinic?
You can find me on LinkedIn and as well as X. Just Google, look for my name in LinkedIn and X, and then you'll find me right there. And so I like to post all of my research on there, and I give a lot of CEs and presentations. A lot of it is in the world of HCM. Some of it is in heart failure. And so if you want to see what I'm up to and come out and say hi and learn some cool stuff that I'm learning, then find me on the socials, and then we can maybe meet up at a conference or something.
Very good. Well, thank you for your time today. I appreciate you joining us. As always, if you like this content, please let us know. Like, subscribe, rate this episode, rate the whole podcast, give us feedback. We want to make this better, continue to engage and be meaningful. So please let us know how we can do that. And I thank everyone for joining, and thank you for the time. And Andrew, thank you. And we'll see you at the next meeting.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all.